Hello, and welcome to our TV, movie, and trailer review podcast brought to you by TPENetwork.com. I'm John.
I'm Amy.
And today we're going to try something a little different. Amy and I will be talking about the latest Transformers movie, Bumblebee. As always, this will be a spoiler-filled conversation, so if you have not seen Bumblebee, you may want to stop the podcast and come back after you have seen the movie. But if you're not worried about spoilers, then let's dive on into this. So, Amy, before we get into this, I just want to discuss our own history with Transformers franchise, just so our listeners can understand where we're coming from with some of our thoughts. I could tell you that from its conception back in 1984, I was a fan and have followed them through all my life until they died out in 93. I got back on board with them for Beast Machines in 1996, but I mean, I was kind of in high school around that time, so I didn't follow them that well. It kind of fell off my radar, but was back on board when the comics came out. IDW came out with a comic line, and it was kind of pitched more towards a serious approach. And since then, every single series that's come out, I've watched in some way or form. And this latest one that's just come out, it's done by Machinima, and it's a YouTube series called Transformer the Prime Wars, and it is spectacular. So that's just kind of where I'm coming from. So there, I have a lot of like personal history towards, you know, looking at these characters. So when we dive down into this further down, if I start going off a tangent, now you know why. So how about okay. You, Amy?
I do not have a lot of Transformers history. I was into a lot of stuff in the 80s that might be coded as boy stuff because, you know, I grew up with a twin brother and we just kind of watched whatever we wanted. And so, you know, I was into Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles, but Transformers, my brother had some Transformers toys and I really enjoyed playing with them, but we never watched the cartoon. So that was about the extent of my knowledge until the first Michael Bay movie came out and I saw that and I really enjoyed it. And then I saw the second one and it was bad and I didn't see any more. So that's about my history with Transformers. Not very extensive.
Yeah, they didn't seem to get any better as they went on. In fact, they kept on getting a lot more convoluted in their lore. So, but I, you know.
I read an article about that last night. It sounded like it just got really complicated and weird.
Well, I mean, maybe I can go on a tangent about this, but let's talk about Bumblebee. We're going to do the standard layout here. So we're going to talk about settings and then we're going to talk about characters, discuss what we thought are the wins of the movie and then what problems we saw with the movie. So our first setting is, on Cybertron. And this is the Cybertron from my childhood with the Great War of Cybertron coming to an end and the evacuation of the Autobots with the Decepticons basically winning the war of attrition. And this very much models just like the original cartoon series and looks nothing like the Transformers The Last Knights version of Cybertron, which I don't know why that they would even thought that was considered Cybertron. So what are your thoughts on this first setting?
Well, my first thought was, wow, if I had been a fan of the comics and knew more about the characters, I would probably really love this. I enjoyed it. I felt like it was a good way to jump into the action, but not alienate people who don't know much about it. It's more like, whoa, this is cool. But I did get that impression that someone who was a dedicated fan would probably just really love it.
Well, I mean, the bigger thing here is that you actually looked at a planet. I think before when we ever seen anything that was Cybertron, it didn't actually look like a planet. It looked like pieces of something that didn't really make much sense. And this actually, you came and you're at a planet. The CGI was done very tastefully. Since the planet's really not in like a sun atmosphere where you get a lot of bright things, them playing it off as being a very dark atmosphere with the explosions and everything that's going on, it helps make it look a lot more synthetic, but that's what the planet is. So
right.
I do believe that their animation for this entire environment was plus. I get two thumbs up from me.
It looked really good. I have to say that. It was very, very well done.
Well, our second setting is Earth, more specifically California in 1987. So we were, Western Shore and dealing with, it kind of reminded me of a lot of Southern California with a lot of desert area where you had reached to, and then, a little bit further on, you hit forest and all. So that kind of made me feel like very Southern California-ish. And from there, we didn't have a lot of different locations. I mean, we had just kind of like the cliffed roads around the coast. We had the woods, which there's a bunch of scenes there. And then besides that city chase, we had the dockyards.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they didn't really expand too much on where we were, which was good because that's a lot of the problems that Michael Bay's films would had, that they put too many locations in and tried to squeeze into a movie and have it make sense. Where in this case, we're focused more on one location and, you know, where a person could literally drive to, not, you know, someone's on the other side of the planet having to deal with, you know, something on the other side of the planet.
Right. Well, I thought that the smaller setting really allowed us to focus more on the characters and it wasn't so overwhelming. And of course, again, being somebody from the West Coast who has spent a lot of time in that part of California, I can tell you it's pretty accurate. I don't think that it was in any real town, but it was supposed to kind of evoke that whole greater Bay Area feel. So you've got the feel of the Muir Woods. You've got the driving scenes on Highway 101, which, you know, Highway 101 goes all the way up the West Coast. So it's up here too. And it's very iconic. So to me, it fit. And it also really brought to mind some of those 1980s movies they were trying to evoke that also take place in California, like E.T. and Karate Kid. And Flight of the Navigator took place in Florida, but it has a very similar feel. So I think they were trying to evoke that movie in there.
How about Mac and Me?
Oh my gosh. I'd almost erase that from my memory.
Side note here, if any of you watch Mystery Science Theater 3000, like the new version of it, that's the first movie on their list that they do.
Did they really? Oh, so, man.
So I went back and watched it, and I'm like, I don't know how I sat through this movie. I know I saw it in the theater, and I have no idea how I did that.
Oh, boy. Well, let's just say that I feel like this Bumblebee kind of brings to mind some of those better 1980s movies. Oh, and I checked because I heard this compared to Herbie the Love Bug a lot. And Herbie the Love Bug, the first one, actually did take place in San Francisco. So, you know, I think they were definitely trying to evoke those kinds of movies when they set this where they did.
Actually, I think the last one was in that area, because if I'm not mistaken, a lot of them, the racing that they were doing, was it Herbie Full Throttle? And that was done on the Salt Flats. Yes, I went to the theaters to see that. I'm a Volkswagen nut. I love Herbie.
I never saw that one, but I grew up watching the original Herbie movies on VHS. So there you go. That was my childhood.
Well, so in the midst of all this, we did have another flashback going back to Cybertron, and we had, to cover a few more grounds. We got to see the evacuation process a little bit more, you know, things that happen afterwards. And which is going to lead us into the characters. So we're going to split this in two, because clearly we have, you know, all the animated characters, which are the Transformers, but then we have all our live human actors. So let's start with the human ones, because clearly they're the ones that we get to deal with more in the movie. So our first person we're going to talk about is Charlie Watson, played by Haley Steinfeld.
Mm-hmm. And so what were your thoughts on her?
You know what? To me, she's an unknown. I haven't seen her really in anything else, but I know that I'm wrong. I know I've seen her in something else, but off the top of my head, it just wasn't clicking. I thought that she did a very good job with, her portrayal of this. You know, she just wanted to kind of stay on her own feet, and it's kind of a, you know, coming into age movie, and I enjoyed her a lot more than the previous Bumblebee companion, Mr. Wickwicky, and the craziness that is him.
Yeah. Well, one thing about her, and this is an eternal problem with movies that they keep casting 20-somethings as teenagers, but she's only 22, and the character she was playing was just turning 18. So she was a lot more believable as a teenager than a lot of adult stars that I've seen. So, you know, I felt like she really came across as a realistic character. And there was more to her than just, oh, she's a girl in the 80s. No, she had a lot of distinctive hobbies and tastes and style, and her personality was really interesting and honestly kind of relatable. I thought they did a really good job of showing a teen girl dealing with the trauma of losing her father and how she was trying to just take care of all of that.
Well, I thought that she really fit what we needed to have opposite Bumblebee for this. I didn't feel like she was trying to jam the character down our throats, if anything, you know, and that seemed to be a lot of the problems that we had with the previous movie. The other thing, too, is she wasn't like a huge sex symbol, like having Megan Fox in the movie, where was basically their entire way of roping in, you know, more young audience. And in this case, you know, she was cute, but she wasn't like she and never did she really show herself off, I guess, if you want to say that, to try and rope people in. I did enjoy going to see a movie that wasn't Bay explosions, you know, with our standard Michael Bay theme, but it also has stuff to do with, you know, let's somehow, you know, tweak the interest of every single person out there by putting in these specific categories of people that there's no way for them to, you know, turn away from.
Well, yeah, I think that's just it. Charlie was a character. Megan Fox was a pinup model who happened to be in a movie.
Yep.
At least that's my impression.
All right. Well, let's see. The next person we'll deal with was Mimo, and that would have been the next door neighbor, played by Georgie Len. I'm going to say this. I'm going to butcher his name. Len Deborg?
Maybe.
So now I'll be honest with this character. I probably could have done without him. He was good there towards the end, but I kind of felt that if anything, he was more of a hindrance. Now, I know and realize that they wanted him there to try and bring the Charlie character down to earth with, you know, her, like with everything that was going on with Bumblebee. But at the same notion, I felt that he was kind of forced in some cases, and in other cases, he was just not needed. But, you know, all in all, I think he did an okay job. But the same notion, he's 22 years old as well. He was able to portray a character a lot younger than what he actually is and get away with it.
Well, I feel like, he seemed like he was there to check the boxes of the 1980s teen movie, which means there has to be a potential romance, probably awkward. I do like that they subverted our expectations a little bit with that. Like, they didn't shut it down, but made it clear that, you know, you're a good friend, but let's just see where this goes. We're not going to throw romance at the camera, because that's not the point of this movie. He also was a good foil to show how capable Charlie was. But you're right. He didn't really serve a lot of purpose other than that. He didn't do anything. He could have been completely left out of the movie, and I don't think we would have noticed a lack.
Yeah, it makes me wonder in the writer's room when they were putting it in, if someone was like, well, no, we need to have someone opposite her, because if not, then she's going to have a movie of talking with, you know, a car the entire time. But that's I don't see where that would be a problem, considering that this movie isn't called Charlie Watson and Mimo. It's called Bumblebee, where if anything, you know, Bumblebee's front and center, and we're dealing with everyone that he has to deal with. So he was a character that, if anything, he was easily forgettable. If it wasn't for the fact that we had to do a lot of research, you know, put something together to make sure that we were, you know, correct with what we're saying, you know, I almost would have forgotten about him.
Yeah, I liked him, but yeah, he was kind of just there. So no real reason to have him, I think.
All right. So our next character is Jack Burns, agent of Section 7, played by John Cena. And I was happy with this. I thought that John Cena did a pretty good job of just being your meathead military guy. I know that he's starting to take a lot more roles in the movie line, and Hank and Alex have issues with their wrestlers integrating into the movie scene. I didn't see that he was that big of a problem. I mean, I don't know who else you really would have put in there, but considering that he looked the part, he could play the role, he doesn't have to worry about talking a whole bunch because, you know, he's just some military guy that basically is like, you know, I want it this way, and that's that. And he has presence wherever he goes. So with that, I do believe that they picked a good character to play this Section 7 agent.
Yeah, I think so. He, again, seemed to check the boxes of the 1980s teen sci-fi movie. You know, you got the meathead military guy, and he did just fine. I have to admit, I'm slightly biased against him because I don't really know a whole lot about WWE, but I have some preschool students who are really, really into it. One who will not stop saying John Cena all the time. So I was like, oh, great, here we go. But that is utterly biased. And putting that aside, I thought he was fine. No problems.
So with that, there is a bunch of other Section 7 characters. I think that everybody else in the movie, nobody ever had enough screen time. I guess the other one was Dr. Powell, agent of Sector 7, which is portrayed by John Ortiz, O-R-T-I-Z. And he's the one that basically is like, hey, we should let them in here and do stuff. And then at the end, he was like, no, they're doing bad stuff. And you know, but honestly, he was not only was he playing the red shirt, but he mm-hmm. deserved every bit of being the red shirt because
set it up that way.
Like, guys, come on. You, alien robots are trying to do stuff. And you're just like, hey, we should just let them do things. I mean, it's funny mm-hmm. because, you know, at the end there, John Cena, you know, gets to basically say, I told you all. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, checking the boxes. This is very much a trope, but it was fine. Yeah. Not terribly memorable, but it's still, you know, it was still entertaining, I guess. But yeah, they had those minor characters that they needed to have to make the story go forward, and it worked. Okay.
But outside of that, there really isn't anyone in particular that was right up front and center that, you know, we're going to mm-hmm. address in this. They did a good job with, you know, doing Phil for the Army Rangers. And just, you know, besides that, I think we should move on to the non-human characters in the movie.
Oh, but before you do that, I just had a quick note about Charlie's family.
Oh, go ahead.
Because, you know, with this type of movie, they've got the whole, oh, the family's so annoying kind of thing. I liked that they started out really annoying, but though not all bad, but they actually get better as the movie goes on, because I think we're seeing them from Charlie's perspective and she's growing as a person and getting over some of her anger with them. So that's why they seem less bad as it goes on, because Charlie's seeing them as less annoying. I don't know if you agree.
I didn't think of it that way, but you know what? I do agree with you with that. That makes a lot of sense. See, mm-hmm. in the end, I mean, I'll be honest. I went to the movie to see, you know, Transformers. Everything else that was going on, I, you know, was second hand. So hearing
about giant robots.
Yeah. Hearing these things that, you know, you put together more of the plot and everything that's going on, you know, it makes sense. And I'm glad that someone could explain that to me. But speaking of the big robots.
Yes, okay. Let's go on to the big robots.
Okay. So the only one that's really of any importance that we connect a person to is that Optimus Prime was voiced by Peter Cullen, the standard when it comes to Optimus Prime, who has basically been carrying the voice of Optimus Prime since the 80s. I really wanted to talk more when it involved these characters, as in the actual appearance of all the Transformers that they had. So let's we'll take a quick step back and just say when Michael Bay introduced the Transformers to us in live action form, everyone was excited, but at the same time, everybody hated what they were doing with the characters but then everyone eventually just kind of got on board. We're like, okay, because Optimus Prime, you know, is a Peterbilt. And he's not supposed to be, you know, have the long front end. Bumblebee is supposed to be a Volkswagen Beetle, not a Camaro, and so on and so on. And then after they transformed, the only one that looked even remotely similar to what they looked like in the 80s was Optimus Prime. And he still didn't really look that close. And he should even had flames on him. So when we mm-hmm. get to this movie and starting off in the beginning and then the flashback in the middle of it, every single Transformer that you see is how they're supposed to look, except for the two triple changers that we see come to Earth. But we'll get to them in a moment. So if we go mm-hmm. down the list, like right away, you see Starscream, you see Shockwave, you see Soundwave, you see Ravage that comes out of Soundwave's chest. You see Optimus Prime, you see Cliffjumper, you see Ratchet, and then, of course, Bumblebee. And everybody there besides Bumblebee looks exactly the way that they're supposed to look as of the 1980s. Now, of course, they rounded off some areas and they made it look a little bit more mechanical. But it's not like, you know, when they the Michael Bay's versions of them that basically, you know, that there were these Transformers because they basically put a name to them. Besides that, there's no way to say, oh, I know who that one is. Like, for example, when they came out with Shockwave for the third Transformers movie, that, I mean, besides the fact that he had the one eye and an arm for a cannon for an arm, that's the only way that you can really tell that he was Shockwave. The Shockwave we saw mm-hmm. here looked exactly the way that it was supposed to. He was purple. He had the yellow eye, had the arm cannon with the hose coming out of it. I mean, that was perfect.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm really glad to hear you say that because I was very curious. I did get the feeling that they were going for a more nostalgic, true to the original characters feel.
What I'm getting at with all this is that, you know, we have characters that have the visual and their faces look the way that they're supposed to as of the cartoon. So for example, like, you know, when we come to Michael Bay's movies, you know, Optimus Prime doesn't have, he never had a mouth. He's like, he has a faceplate. And like Wheeljack doesn't have a mouth. He's got these little plates on the side of his head that flash. And these are the things that they did in the movie that Michael Bay never did. And to me, that really didn't relate. And it kind of upset me because these are the ways these Transformers are supposed to be. So like when we end up on Mars and the triple changers are there dealing with a Cliff Jumper, that is exactly how Cliff Jumper looks from the cartoon, minus, you know, they made him a little bit more machiny, but, you know, they did such a good job of making sure that they can take the original 1980s Transformers and relate to a modern day show versus the nonsense that Michael Bay had with trying to take Transformers, make new things out of them, and then just slap names on it that we knew. Like a good example was Soundwave. Soundwave like came over and took over a satellite and then shot down a weird like tiger looking thing that I guess was supposed to be Ravage. And then at some point in time in the next movie, he was a car. And I mean, basically in the end, they did a good job of not going down these roads. So the triple changers that they had there. So there were actually three of them. One of them got taken out at the beginning. It was the one that was dealing with Bumblebee, and he's the one who took out his voice modulator. That one, man, I forgot that one's name. And I was just looking.
Yeah, I don't remember. I was looking that up too, but.
Well, he's the one that turns into a MiG as well as he flips and turns into a tank when that was the toy version. But in this one, he was a Harrier jet and apparently turned into a Cybertronian tank. You know what? It doesn't really matter. But he was one of them. And then the other two, you know, they had the Transformers there. So they actually had their very first female Transformer that was on screen the entire time and not like the first. So they also had RC, which was an Autobot that came from the Transformers 1980s movie. And she was in there as well in the background. She was one of the Autobots, but she wasn't.
Oh, I think I saw that.
She didn't have a speaking role. But but this other one, this Decepticon, she did. And besides, you know, the pseudo RC that they had in one of the other movies where she was a motorcycle, I mean, that really didn't count. She didn't really even seem like she was a Transformer. But this was a big push that they're actually, you know, showing that there are definitely two, I guess, sexes when it comes to the Transformers themselves.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I liked about that, well, first of all, wasn't she voiced by Angela Bassett?
Yes.
Yeah, she did a good job. But I liked that she didn't have a personality that was just, oh, she's female. No, they were Shatter and Dropkick, I believe, was their names. And they each had their own personalities. Like she was kind of the smart one. And he was sort of the, I just want to wreck everything. So, you know, it was fun.
Oh, it's Blitzwing. I don't know why I couldn't remember that. I was actually looking.
Oh, the first one. Yeah. The first one.
But I am very happy with the way that they portrayed all these Transformers. Now, I think that you told me previously that you had some questions that you wanted to ask me about.
Yeah, I was curious about Bumblebee because when I first saw the first Michael Bay Transformers movie, I just really liked Bumblebee and I liked him even more in this movie. And I'm kind of curious, did they do the same thing with him? Did they go back to what he was originally like? Like the fact that he is little. He's smaller than all the others because, you know, he's a VW bug, as opposed to the Camaro from the new movie. Yeah, that actually bugged me when I saw the first one, because even though I didn't know much about Transformers, I knew, wait, he's not supposed to be a Camaro. And I also wondered, he goes by the name B-127. Is that how it was originally, or did they make that up for this movie?
Let's start with how he looks. Okay, so Bumblebee, for all intents and purposes, does not look like how he did in the cartoon series. In the cartoon series, he had an actual more plain face, and he had like two little yellow horns that kind of came out of the side of it. His body was more representative of a beetle versus what we have with this one. But you know what? Considering of all the other Bumblebees we've had in the past, I don't care that they didn't make him look exactly the same. They still used Bumblebee for the time frame. But it's also keep in mind, he also was a Jeep there for a little bit in the movie, which that's not something he does in the animated series, at least as far as I remember, because I know that he had two incarnations. He was Bumblebee and he was Goldbug, you know, towards the end of the Generation 2 line. Size-wise, yes, they did a better job bringing them down. For the cartoon, Bumblebee and Cliffjumper were relatively always the same size, if not maybe just a little bit taller than a human. Now, he was clearly still taller, but you're right. He wasn't as tall as like in the Michael Bay movies. But that was always kind of a thing that, you know, animation styles, you know, it all depends. Maybe sometimes he was drawn a little bit bigger, but he never really was huge. So what was the last part of that you were asking? Oh, the
B-127.
I have never heard the name B-127 mentioned in that. Now, there are comic books that predate even the 1984 series, and maybe in there that was something that was used, and I would totally believe that because I don't know where they would pull that from, but none of the other Transformers that we have ever seen have ever had a number in their name. So that makes
me wonder. That's the only thing that bugged me, because I can see why they did it, because he had no voice and probably very little memory and couldn't tell Charlie what his name was. So she gave him a name, but I don't know why he would have a letter and a number as opposed to the actual names all the other Transformers had.
Yeah,
it's a minor nitpick, though. I don't really care that much.
Well, that would be, we can just shuffle that down into problems. Mm-hmm. So speaking of which, let's go to where the wins and the problems that we see with the movie. So for me, the wins is that we're finally fixing the Transformers continuity problem that Michael Bay had with all of his previous movies by having the Transformers not only look like their 1980 counterparts in robot mode, but transformed into whatever they transformed into still looked the part as well. And this was not basically a giant GM commercial like all of Michael Bay's videos were.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, Shockwave looks like Shockwave. Soundwave looks like Soundwave. Ravage jumps out of Soundwave's chest just like he's supposed to. Mm-hmm. And he's not, you know, the saber-toothed tiger-looking thing from the Michael Bay movies. Also, this gives us a reason why in the Michael Bay movies, you know, Bumblebee doesn't talk, and not just saying to us that, oh, you know, he had a problem, you know, or something happened to him and we had to, you know, and just, you know, we're just going to sweep that underneath the table and not have to worry about explaining any further. And all in all, it wasn't a movie where I jumped out of my seat in every single moment. It was very predictable, but it was definitely something that was a lot more entertaining than the last three Michael Bay flicks.
Oh, yeah. And I felt like the big wins for this movie for me were Charlie and Bumblebee as characters in their own right and as the relationship they had. Bumblebee was just fun. He was a charming character. He was funny. He made mistakes. He was a little bit reckless and brash. At the same time, he was a little bit nervous and fearful. And they showed this just through the animation with no voice. I've always liked the idea of the fact that, oh, he speaks through the radio, but I thought it was especially fun that they showed why he had to do that and how he learned to use the radio. That just kind of delighted me. Oh, and I have to bring this up. Even though I've never seen the Transformers animated movie, the part where they start playing the song on the radio from that movie.
Yes,
I just sort of cheered in the theater. I was like, that's awesome.
Well, see, and that was one of the pluses I had. So clearly the people who put this movie together, they actually watched the Transformers. And they weren't there saying, oh, well, let's just throw money at this and make a movie. They were actually looking out for their fans, and they're giving us homages to everything.
Yes, including their fans. They love what they're doing.
And they were giving homages to Michael Bay himself by doing all these toss outs to the things that they did in or all of his movies. So
yeah, I can see that. I did think that worked. I think that even if you are not a diehard fan, like I'm not a diehard fan, it comes across, and the love that they have for the movie they're making comes across, and I enjoy it more because of it.
All right, so now let's talk about some of the problems that we have with the movies. Really, the only problem I have with this movie is how hard they try to connect it to the already existing franchise that Michael Bay made. This is a movie that can completely stand alone and has the ability itself to restart the franchise that has gotten way far out of control with its crazy lore, like the entire end of the movie, which was, you know, an issue that I had, where basically, you know, there, Bumblebee turns into the Camaro and he meets up with Optimus Prime. But so here's the things where you get conflicted. Okay, well, first off, he meets up with Optimus Prime. If we're trying to say this leads into the next, to the actual Transformers movie, Optimus Prime was not on the planet. He actually kind of got parachuted in. So now if they're trying to retcon that, that's one thing. At least Optimus Prime actually looked like the Peterbilt truck that he's supposed to, with the trailer that he is supposed to have. Now, having Bumblebee drive next to him as a Camaro was kind of like conflicting, feelings of like, okay, well, here we are trying to leave it off, you know, leading into the Michael Bay movies, but clearly it can't be because Optimus Prime is not there and he looks like the way he's actually supposed to look. He ended up being in Michael Bay's movie and things like that. They didn't need to do that. They didn't need to give homage to Michael Bay's movies at all. And I don't really know why they did that.
It's almost like they were setting it up for a reboot, but not a total reboot. And I'm not sure where they're going with it.
Well, no, but that's the thing is I want them to do this as a reboot. I want to forget about the other movies. They don't need to connect at all.
So it tied into the Michael Bay movies too much for your taste.
Yes.
Okay. That's fair.
If we're going to go back and we're going to correct all the wrongs that Michael Bay did, why are we introducing this entire franchise and that looks like it leads right back into the franchise that's messing everything up?
I don't know. I kind of like the whole, he turns into a Camaro at the end. That explains that. But that, it's personal preference. And I get it. The Michael Bay movies leave such a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths that, we could have done without it.
Okay. And then the movie is very predictable. it is supposed to have, if this being some sort of prequel, we already know, the people who are supposed to survive through this. And the fact that it calls out so many Bay films, like I said already, that it really didn't need to. Really, I really wish they had not done that. So in the end, that's my biggest issue is that we made a movie that is righting the wrongs that they did in other movies, but we're giving toss outs or call outs to the movie that did wrong. And then we end it with the possibility of making it look like it can connect to that line. So I don't know why they would have.
Well, I thought it was pretty predictable because it was fitting that 1980 sci-fi movie formula. And in that way, it didn't bother me so much because, they're trying to tap into that nostalgia, that affection for the movies of the era. So that part of the predictability I can deal with. But there were a few just things that kind of broke me out of the movie that bugged me that don't really have to do with Transformers in particular, but just like writing and plot. Like, for example, and this is something that bugs me a lot about 80s movies that involve teens, is they should have gotten in way more trouble from the police chase and trashing the house.
Yep.
So that didn't feel realistic to me. But other than that, my other complaints are pretty much just like, Memo was an underutilized character. And the things that you've mentioned. And other than that, I thought it was fine.
Well, in that case, what would you give this movie in a rating from 1 to 10?
I'm going to say a 7 because it was good, solid fun, but not necessarily something where you have to see it in the theater. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely fun and a lot better than the Michael Bay movie.
I was going to give this a 6, but after hitting towards the end here, I think I just give it about a half point more. I'd do 6.5 in this. Again, it was a good movie. It wasn't a great movie, but if we're comparing it to all the other Michael Bay movies, then we basically, those are 5 or below. And if anything, you're watching it just to be confused, like for the base explosions, but you're confused as all heck. So
it was a refreshing palate cleanser. That's my opinion.
Oh, very good. So, well, there is Amy's and my review for Bumblebee. So if you guys would like to send us some feedback, reach out to us at tpenetwork.com. Amy, thank you very much for joining me on this podcast.
Yeah, thanks very much. Let's get out of here before Hank gets back.
Oh, yeah. We got to do that. So, all right. Well, for Amy, I'm John. Until next time, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
I just finished up Bumblebee. I'm ready to start the podcast.
Keep that in.
Tiger Prince Entertainment.
There ain't nothing else like it.